Pole position. I'm Mike McGinnis.
And I'm Jeff Prescott.
And this is No Quarter. Yes, I really mean it. It is actually No Quarter. We are back. And most of you out there are probably wondering, well, you just posted another episode like a few days ago, didn't you? And yes, we did. But that episode, Thayer's Quest, was recorded actually way back in May. And it's just been sort of sitting on my hard drive because we took the summer off. And you can say that we maybe were enjoying the sun or the swimming pools or just generally recovering from the awfulness that was Thayer's Quest. But whatever the case, we're back. How are you, Jeff?
Don't call it a comeback, Mike.
Oh, no.
It's
a good thing we don't have any listeners at all, or they'd be groaning and rolling their eyes just like I am.
Sure.
So how was your summer?
Brief and lovely and over.
Yeah, that tends to go faster and faster, I think, as the years tend to slip by. And before we get all dark and depressed and
sad, yeah, we've already had that conversation.
we've kind of went on about that before we started recording. So we'll spare you most of that and just say, hey, welcome back. We're playing Pole Position this week.
Oh, I recorded it.
Oh, no.
Use Black what you military. Will. Right, exactly.
Yeah, so, not Black Mail Material. Welcome to the Black Mail Material Podcast.
Bulletin board material, right?
Right. Pole Position. Tell me about Pole Position.
First of all, I want to preface this with Pole Position's like high up in the echelon of these classic games, I think.
I mean,
I'm sure you feel the same, and if you don't, please elaborate. But if I roll back the synapses to the arcades of 1982/3, when, you know, we were just pumping our lunch money in there, and you think back to that cacophony and that texture of sound and racket, you can hear the attract mode. The boop, 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 boop. Like, that plays on an endless loop in my soul. And that is part of the tapestry of the awesomeness of the arcade nostalgia for me. It's woven into the fabric of my whole memory about the arcade. So I have a special place in my heart for this damn game.
Yeah, well, this was actually your suggestion. And I remember the joy I heard in your voice when you suggested it. So I like Pole Position. It's probably top 15, top 20 for me. Not my favorite driving game, but yeah, nothing to hate here. So let's talk a little bit about the tech first and then the history of the game. It was released by Namco in 1982, licensed to Atari for manufacture and distribution in the United States. It was designed by Toru Iwatani, and yes, you recognize that name from Pac-Man. Pole Position was the most popular game of 1983, and really it's obvious as soon as you start playing it why, because if you play some of these earlier games from like 80, 81, they tended to be the top down, and they were fun driving games, but you didn't really feel like you were in the race. And with this, you're there. You got the screeching wheels and the acceleration of the cars and the weird explosions. And yeah, it's a great game.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're doing yourself a disservice if you're not old enough, or if you are old enough and you just neglected it. If you didn't experience this game in the environmental cabinet, then your life's not complete. It's just not.
This brings up an interesting point because I think we haven't played a lot of driving games on No Quarter because this is a category where the emulation is much further away from the arcade experience than some of these other ones. And driving games in general are kind of, I think, I don't collect them, the stand-ups or anything, but I would imagine this might be a frustrating thing to collect too, because you can't just build like really a generic driving cabinet and put all the games in it, because they all had their own wheels. Some of them had different gearing, some had pedals, some didn't. Even this one had a different pedal configuration depending on whether you're playing the stand-up or the environmental, if I remember.
Yeah, the Environmental actually has a brake pedal, and it's metallic, and it's feature-rich. I mean, there's acceleration, brake, gear shift, the crazy steering wheel where only 30 degrees matter, and the whole rest of the time you're spinning it pointlessly. As a 10-year-old and or 9-year-old, and embracing this thing upon, like, the first time ever it graced my eyesight, I mean, this is one of those few games where it wasn't an abstraction. I mean, it's like, hey, let's pop in a Formula One and go around the Fuji track. I mean, you were dying and itching to get behind the wheel of a car, your mom's car, the truck, whatever. And here's a game where you could actually assimilate and maybe feel the visceral thrill of, you know, driving a digital car and to actually, you know, mimic something that was in the real world. I mean, nobody thought, you know, I'm going to pilot a spaceship and blow up bugs like in Galaga, but you're like, I'm going to drive one day, and cars are really flammable.
Yeah, it's amazing how many puddles of water just make your car explode.
Are they water or oil slicks?
What I'm reading is that they were puddles of water.
Really?
But I think probably depending on the game, it's actually, we've been on this game since May, since we played Thayer's Quest, and it's been a while since I played, but I thought they were the bright blue puddles of water, but... I
actually coded a sequel.
Yeah, well, and speaking of the sequel, yeah, there was a sequel, Pole Position 2, which came out a year later, and in fact, when we first started playing this, I was sort of confused because I kept waiting for the map or the screen to come up that allowed me to choose the racetrack that I wanted to play on. I thought, there's something wrong with the ROM, and then I went and read, and oh, that's the second game, because they came out close together, and they do share sort of a visual similarity. And this is a game like, you loved it and everybody loved this game. In fact, it sold 21,000 machines. It made $61 million on machine sales in the United States, which would be like $150 million now. Plus it was earning $450 million a week or no, can't be that much.
I think all time. Yeah.
Oh, okay. $450 a week per machine, which is a lot of quarters. And I remember when, like, the local bowling alley got one of these, and there were lines to play it. There were people who waited to play this game.
And what's so brilliant about Pole Position, too, from, you know, the shekel perspective, these games are brief. I mean, you attempt to qualify, you don't pass enough cars, you don't make the lap, your game's over in less than 90 seconds.
Well, and even if you did, the game ended. It didn't continue when you beat the main race.
Right. Well, you could get extended play, I think, right? Like if you finished under a certain threshold, but you could only earn like one extra lap and then you're done. So the game takes like 5 minutes, no matter how good you do.
Although, as far as I understand it, not many people actually finish this game.
Yeah, me either. This thing's pumping like co 16-bit microprocessors too. I mean, like
let's talk about the hardware. So,
no, I mean, I'm just astounded that there's essentially, you know, 32-bit in parallel, you know, running this code. And it's a two-board stack. It's a monster. There's, like, a variety of custom chips, like, all over the board, like all the stupid Namco games. One extra awesome point about the environmental cabinet. I'm looking in the Atari literature here. They're calling it quadraphonic sound. There's 4 6-ounce hi-fi speakers in the cabinet, 2 under the control panel and 2 behind you. I don't
16-bit audio.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a kind of a monster. They built this machine specifically for this game, which obviously a lot of the arcade games were, but so many more were built on, you know, the broken, empty husks of the previous generation of whatever processor. But this thing had, as its main CPU, a Zilog Z80 at 3.072 megahertz, a secondary CPU setup of two Zilog Z8002 chips, also at 3.072 megahertz. It had an IO MCU, which was a Fujitsu MB8843 at 1.454 megahertz, and another MB8844 also at 1.54 megahertz. It had a sound CPU, one of the secondary CPUs was also used for sound. It had its own sound board, and which included the Namco 52XX audio processor and the 54XX audio generator and two Fujitsu MB8843s just for sound, and a GPU chipset, three Namco 02XX GFX shifters. These are 16-bit video shifters, two Namco 03 play field data buffer chips, a Namco 04XX sprite address generator, and a Namco 09XX sprite RAM buffer. So this thing ran like silk for a reason.
Yes, it's...
That's crazy.
They threw the kitchen sink at this thing. I can only imagine, like, just engineering these boards must have been a nightmare.
It had the standard 256 by 224 raster graphics, color palette of 4,092, which is, I guess, 12-bit RGB, although it only ever had 3,840 colors on screen at any given time. Boo, boo. So
yeah, well, it was enough to assault my senses. It's okay. And product placement. Product placement.
Oh, and what they called pseudo 3D sprites. So the whole thing looked kind of low res and blocky, but it never felt like, I was never looking at this thing wondering, what am I looking at? Because like you said, there were product placement on the billboard, depending on the version of the game that you're playing, that the billboards were different. So the Namco ones had like Coke and Pepsi and like Marlboro and things like that.
I know, awesome, like Marlboro and Martini and Rossi, like awesome.
Yeah. I think Atari went for the more family-friendly fare and just advertised their own games.
Yeah, cheap. Yeah, like Centipede was on a billboard. You're like, okay, thanks for the shameless plug, you bastards.
You guys
suck. And like Dentine gum, come on. Like,
oh god, remember Dentine?
Exactly. Like, what is this, like a public service announcement? I'm trying to play a game here. Get back to the Marlboro Man, come on.
So the interesting thing is that like when you think arcade driving games, this one is on every top 10 list and usually at or right near the top. And the thing is, it wasn't the first, it wasn't the most advanced, at least not for very long, but because it was such a well done experience, this is the one that, you know, everybody goes to.
Right. And like you said, it was, the scaling is magnificent. The frame rate is epic. I mean, the thing moves faster than you can possibly process it in your own head.
It was also maddeningly frustrating when you would get, like, you know, you could see the crash coming as you're starting to skid off the road and there's the billboard coming, and you know, but you can't let off the pedal in time. Yeah, it's...
You know, a friend of mine even... Well, let's bestow another accolade on this game, actually, Mike. A friend of mine brought to my attention the fact that this game is incredibly prescient. The edges of the course, when you roll off the side of the road and you start to make the drrrr noise, think about, like, that didn't actually become a thing on actual highways until, like, what, 2000? Maybe 1998? Yeah, the year falling asleep.
When you're...
Right, right. Yeah. You're drifting, up, idiot. Wake up. Exactly. Like, that was in pole position in 82. And that's a real thing now. So, props, Atari, Namco.
I said that this game isn't my favorite driving game, but I sure enjoyed playing it and definitely talking about it. It ended up, I think, pretty much on every platform and home console and computer of the day. It was ported to everything because the gameplay was really simplistic. It's, you know, we talk a lot about what makes a game successful on this podcast, and a lot of it has to do with the ability just to walk up and know what you're doing. I mean, teenagers who'd never driven before got how to play this game.
Right. I mean, you put the hammer down and you're in low gear and you wait until you get to about 90 to 100, I think it's kilometers, crazy Japanese. And then you throw it in high gear and just, you know, white knuckle your way into poverty, essentially, because it takes quarter after quarter after quarter.
Yeah, but see, the difference between Pole Position and Thayer's Quest...
That's a long list, my friend.
Well, yeah. Okay, for this specific example, okay. We talked about Thayer's Quest and how to get further in the game, you had to pump more quarters into it. And the difference is, like, in Thayer's Quest, because it was just a trial and error, like, menu choices, you had to play the game over and over and over. And you know, okay, the second option at this screen is the way to go, because the first one I ended up picking a flower and dying, or I ended up falling, drinking poison water and dying. Where this actually feels a little bit better. It feels like a more organic experience, and I'm happy to pump more quarters into this.
Yeah, I thoroughly agree. I couldn't take my money, the meme, throw my fucking wallet at it. Sorry. Like, unreal. Unreal.
So yeah, the whole thing is, the game itself is fairly simple. You have a qualifying lap, and that you, in which you have, like, I think 90 or 120 seconds, depending on the dip switch settings,
right,
to finish the qualifying lap. And if you do, then you advance to the racetrack at Mount Fuji, where you race seven other, you start out at the starting line with seven other cars, and more cars show up as you continue to race. But if you don't qualify, you get to go ahead and finish the qualifying lap, and then the game's over. I like that if you didn't qualify, you still get to play a little bit more. It just feels more realistic than, game stops right there.
Yeah, it's a nice mechanic where they're dangling that carrot in front of you, and it's hard to resist. I mean, The only real critique I can levy on this game is it's so brief, you know, especially when you suck at it like I do.
Yeah, I was not very good at this back then, and I didn't get much better over the years.
Did this scar you, Mike? Like, when you were young and you played this and you thought, man, like, driver's ed, I'm gonna die.
No, I don't think it took over that much of my life. It sounds like it did for you, though.
It kind of did. I mean, I thought for a while that cars were built out of napalm, for crying out loud. I mean, you die horribly in this game. I mean, it's fire and brimstone awful.
Yeah, you do blow up a lot.
A lot. And when you touch a billboard, it doesn't matter. You know, a possum in the road, it doesn't matter. You're going up in a blaze of glory. Like, it's
touch another car, you're gone.
Right, and they don't blow up. They just continue to haul ass down the track. What's up with that? Yeah, I mean, if I could somehow figure out how to code my car to be invulnerable like the CPU cars, well, actually, this game would get really boring in a hurry. Never mind. Have you ever seen or experienced the TX1 racer that came out, like, in 84? Because apparently Atari and Tatsumi, another Japanese company, without Namco's approval or blessing from what I can figure out, you know, formulated basically a Pole Position 3-esque game, and it was a sit-down cabinet with three television screens in front of you, like a left view, a center view, and a right view, like spread across all three, like multiple monitors?
No, I mean, I read about that as like an unofficial sequel, but I've never seen it.
Right, I've seen still photographs of the machine in play, and like your field of vision is basically like 60 inches wide. It's incredible, but I've never seen the machine actually, you know, running. And I'm hoping one day somebody somewhere, you know, has one that I can enjoy.
Well, I'm sure you can play this until they do.
Yeah, Pole Position will do just fine. Now, this game blows in MAME, I'm just gonna say. Like,
yeah.
Find a steering wheel. The upright's acceptable. The environmental is where you need to be if you have any real passion for arcade games.
I agree. And unfortunately, yeah, it's, and even buying a wheel for your PC or Mac,
boo,
it's not going to be the same, but it's better than paying $3,000 or $4,000 or whatever these things are going for now, because these are expensive machines, aren't they?
The sit downs, yes, very much so. But the uprights, a couple hundred bucks probably. Like, and they probably don't work. The board set's a real pain in the ass.
Just because it was over engineered, or is there something else going on?
No, it's due largely to the regulator, the audio regulator board, and the Atari machining. The 5-volt line and the 12-volt line tend to heat up a lot and burn the edge of the board, and you have to jumper it, you have to repair the fingers, and the TO3 that regulates the 5 volts basically over time dries up or dies, and stuff starts going south, and resistance builds up, and it gets crispy. For whatever reason, Pole Position is a very demanding board set. So these voltages, I guess, are getting strewn all over the place between the architecture of like co-PCBs. And I guess over time they go pear-shaped. They're not terrible to repair as long as the customs aren't fried.
Well, that might explain why. Okay, so when Namco produced this game and was looking for someone to publish it in North America, I guess they went to both Atari or they went to either Bally or Bally and Atari. And they had two games. They had this, and they had Mappy, and Bally chose Mappy.
Mappy, right? Oh,
yeah, also a great and very popular game.
Yeah, but great moments in arcade history. In the hinterworld, I mean, Bally has to utterly regret that decision.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, what did Mappy make? Like $8? And Pole Position made $40 million? I mean, come on.
Well, I think Mappy probably did a little bit better than that. But
yeah, okay, sure. Okay.
I'd say Mappy is probably in a lot of people's top 50 list, but this is top 10 for almost everybody.
I mean, Mappy's got better depth, then I guess maybe we'll start championing Mappy for an edition of this podcast in the future. But I'd probably rather play against Cats and Mice, but this one's gonna draw me in and I'm gonna want to play it over and over and over again for short bursts until I rage quit.
There you go.
Right, this is a rage quitter, right? Am I right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, you slammed the lid down on that laptop more than once. I mean, I know I did.
Put my fist through a few screens.
Nice.
Yeah, it is frustratingly difficult, but it's easy to go and pick up and figure it out. But yeah, it's tough to get anywhere.
And the sequel wasn't fair either. You know, I mean, it's the same. I can't. What do you have about 15 degrees counterclockwise and clockwise on the steering wheel? Like the key to this game is basically not oversteering. You never really have to use the brake, and you have to power through sharp corners. But it's all about those few degrees, right? Like, I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
For me, it was always those sharp corners because that was when I think the point in the game where your field of vision is most limited. You really can't see what's coming.
And right.
If you're speeding through those sharp corners, that the game will conveniently throw a car in front of you, and you just have no time to get out of the way.
Yeah.
Or you just oversteer and end up spinning out and blowing up. Yeah, it is one tough game.
I mean, I just lay off the gas and let it kind of sift down to about 140 until I get the apex of the curve and then hit it again. You need to power through that curve and then you'll stick. If you hit it again at the right time, you'll stick and hug the curve. If you screw up too early, you'll veer off the side and blow up on a centipede billboard for sure.
Yeah, there's certainly a sweet spot there.
There is.
It's pretty narrow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not reproducible for me, but you're right. It's there. And if you can nail it every time, I guess that's how you get good at this game.
Yeah, as I was playing this, that was one of the things that stuck out for me was considering how kind of, blocky in early 1980 this looks, the play was remarkably sophisticated for driving and turning the wheel. Like you said, it's a very limited window of degrees or whatever the term is that the wheel actually matters. But within that, boy, it really makes a difference. And
amen.
I mean, it's just a couple of a light touch here and there makes the difference between a good game and a really bad one. And man, I had a lot of really bad games and not many good ones.
And isn't Pole Position kind of unique in the canon here too? Like in 83, essentially, I mean, it came out mid 82, but I guess it really took fire in 83. And that's basically when it came out in Europe too. And the world could appreciate it. It's a game, especially for Namco with all these cutesy characters, the Dig Dug, the Mappy, the Pac-Man. Pole Position is utterly abstract and eminently applicable to your imagination. I mean, you put yourself in that Formula One racer. There's no facade, there's no character, there's no cutesy Japanese critter smiling at you, urging you to pump money into the machine. Like, it's eminently approachable, and it doesn't assume some identity. I mean, it's you can just dissolve into the screen. For me, that's part of the magic.
Yeah, there's so many things to like about this game. I'm not a big fan of, like, you know, the ultra-violent shoot 'em up and blow up games. And I think that was probably one of the selling points of, and you know, early 80s ad execs, I think, kind of took the sexist route and went, women love this game too, but there's no, the only violence is your car exploding.
And that happens a lot.
You're not punching anyone, you're not shooting anyone, so.
Right. It's all self-inflicted pain. And as painful as it is, though, and this is something you always mention, like, I don't think the deaths are cheap. I mean, I always feel that, yeah, I screwed the pooch on that one. My bad.
And watching playthrough videos from people who are a lot better than me, I can see that, oh, yeah, these were all my fault.
Right, right. Yeah, when they're threading the needle and stuff, and you're like, oh, this really is possible.
I tend to like to think of myself as the best at everything the first time I try it, you know, and so if I can't do it, well, nobody can. And then I see these videos, I'm like, oh, yeah.
That's an interesting point. Like, have you ever tracked your gameplay over, you know, 4 or 5 credits and then, you know, graphed it and just noticed where the peak of, you know, like the talent for the moment is? Like, game one, maybe you got 8,200, game two, maybe 9,000. And then the next 3 or 4 credits, like, you just continued to descend. And then you're like, well, game two, that's pretty much where I hit my stride. And then there's no point in playing this game any further. I mean, like, the decay on this for Robotron for me is pretty much immediate. But Pole Position, it takes me 3 or 4 credits to really get into it. I think it's the time to adjust to that weird hanky steering mechanic. And like we were saying earlier, when you hit the sweet spot and like you can like grip a turn and all of a sudden the wheels aren't, you know, laced with, you know, oil anymore or water or whatever. And you're actually gripping the track and you're feeling like you're controlling the game and the game's not pushing you around. It takes me 4 or 5 games to really to hit it. And then there's a brief, you know, 4 or 5 minutes where I feel like I'm in control. And then it all falls apart.
You're like, yeah, I could get a world high score here and then immediately die.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, who was I kidding?
Come right, on. Yeah, I don't have any aspirations to ever have a world record. I
harbor no illusions about that.
Yeah, yes. And no skills.
It was such a popular phenomenon in the early 80s that Atari went so far as to produce a series of commercials for that ran exclusively on MTV. I would play the audio for this one, but like, so the first 30 seconds of it is like this Muffy Buffy, whatever, yuppies go out for a drive. And then it's all just like sounds and yelling and engines. And, however, at the very end of the, commercial, it wraps up with the voiceover announcer going, Pole Position from Atari. It'll bust your crank and leave skid marks on your soul, which I'm pretty sure was, like the subtitle or the subheading to like a Japanese oculolinctus porn I saw once.
Oh, look it up, kids. Man. That's...
You'll thank me later, but.
Yikes.
But it showed up everywhere. I mean, it was in background movie. I saw, I think.
You've seen this ad? Like back in the day?
Well, not the ad. The game showed up everywhere, though. I mean, like, I remember. Do you remember a movie called Daryl in the 80s about the robotic kid?
Yeah. Wasn't it an acronym? Yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah, data analyzing something. Right. I don't know. But it was a terrible movie, but it was a guilty pleasure of mine. And one of the things that he did was like play 8 video games simultaneously while watching television.
Oh, my
and
God.
This and that. And this was one of the games that he played. And I like that what happens in the movie, in order to make it look like it's getting it, he's having, in order to make it look like a real challenge, is they speed the video up so it looks like it's just flickering past. But yeah, it showed up in a lot of movies and pop culture. It was big, huge, huge game.
Yeah. I wish I had seen that advertisement back in the day. I gotta look on YouTube or whatever and appreciate that for what it is and hopefully avoid the tentacles. But, you've come clean on a guilty pleasure from the 80s, filmic guilty pleasure. So I'll just say that I've got a soft spot for Night of the Comet, and Catherine Mary Stewart is still very hot to this day. And there's an awesome Tempest in that game that looks even better. Spoken like a true nerd.
I think this game also appeared in Joysticks, which was another arcade game movie from the 80s.
We should do an episode on Joysticks.
Yeah, in we fact, should. I think maybe we will do that.
We should watch that game, Mystery Science Theater style, and just harangue it. Yeah, I mean, maybe break it down into scenes so we don't have to watch the entire thing and bore everyone for 90 minutes. But I think we could condense the best parts of it in there and just jab away at it. And, you know, we'll make a drinking game out of it or something like that. That deserves to be lampooned badly.
We'll put a pin in that and definitely revisit that in the future.
Cool.
So back
to reality.
Yeah, back to reality, I guess, that I suck at this game, and I'm pretty sure you do as well.
You suck at this game, and I suck at this game.
There was a little competition for the world high score, kind of back and forth between two guys back in the 80s, Mike Klug and Les, is it Logier, Logier? They went back and forth trying to get the high score on this. Apparently, Les racked up the highest score and still holds that record to date of 67,310 points. And I haven't bothered to look through the nerdy math behind it, but there are people who are saying that score is it can't be beaten.
Yeah, I question if that score is even valid.
Oh, why is that?
Because mine's so low by comparison.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to this day, at least according to Twin Galaxies and a couple of other these record keeping sites, Les is still number one and Mike is still number two. And Richie Knuckles is number three. So how'd you do?
Poorly. Poorly. You go first. I'm embarrassed.
I got 10,900.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I'm terrible.
Wow. All right. Well, I actually played on a real machine, not mine, but a friend of mine. So I had the benefit of like the actual steering wheel. So
oh, so did I. Yeah.
Oh. Well, I was trying to do you a solid. Sorry. I got 16,000. Even was the best I could manage.
At least I tied you in Thayer's Quest. How's that?
Yeah. Okay. Let's
with 0 points.
Let's put that ugly episode behind us. There wasn't any scoring in that game, was there?
That was kind of my point.
Well, it's late. All right.
Let's see, what else? Is there anything else we should say about this before we wrap up?
I'm sure that there's probably more gushing I could do, but it's just rhetorical at this point. Cool game. It's probably, I would put this in my favorites file, for sure, but I would never play it on the Mac. find a real steering wheel. And uprights are pretty cheap. If you're building an arcade, you know, this is one, and we're talking ubiquitous games here. I mean, this game, would they make 60,000 of these damn things? The uprights? Like, not too hard to acquire. They're ubiquitous and pretty cheap. And if you really want a driver and you can't afford Sega, because they made the awesomest driving games, probably, this is, like I said before, like a truly iconic and well-deserved machine and a staple of any legit serious classic arcade.
Yeah, well, and especially in a field so crowded with outstanding driving games in the 80s that you could play in the arcade, to stand out so far, you know, so head and shoulders above the rest like it does is really a statement of what a great job Namco and Toru did with this.
Agree. Like, I mean, I have no desire to fire up Gran Turismo, but I'll play Pole Position until I'm blue in the face. Right now. Like, tomorrow. And I've been playing this game since May, and I mean, I'm going to play it again tonight. Okay. No, I'm not.
Well, what other game are you going to play tonight?
None.
You got to pick something. We can't play this one again. At least.
Hey, it's your turn, buddy. It sounds like this, doesn't it?
Okay, well, I'm sure everyone will hate that, and they will blame me for that, and that's just
fine. Oh, I can't wait to hear. I really can't.
All right. Well, thank you once again, Jeff. And thank you, everyone else, for tuning in. All six of our listeners. We appreciate it.
We certainly do. Thanks for your patience and your understanding.
And hopefully we'll get back on a more regular and frequent publishing schedule.
Yeah, there's always hope.
In the meantime, we'll see you soon.
Bye, everyone. North Sports Club.